This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. An influential Shiite cleric announced that he will resign from Iraqi politics, and hundreds of his angry followers responded by storming the government palace. The move sparked violent clashes with security forces in which at least 15 protesters were killed. Medical officials said dozens of protesters were wounded by gunfire. More were injured by tear gas and physical altercations with riot police. The protest on Monday followed the announcement by Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. Iraq's government has been deadlocked since al-Sadr's party won the largest share of seats in the October parliamentary elections, but not enough to secure a major government. A UN nuclear watchdog team set off on an argument or an urgent mission on Monday to safeguard the Russian-occupied atomic power plant at the heart of fighting in Ukraine. It's a long-awaited trip the world hopes will help avoid a radioactive catastrophe. The stakes couldn't be higher for the International Atomic Energy Agency experts who will visit the plant in a country where the 1986 Chernobyl disaster spewed radiation throughout the region, shocking the world and intensifying global pushes away from nuclear energy. Underscoring the urgency, Ukraine and Russia both have accused each other of shelling the wider region around the nuclear power plant. Europe's largest, which was briefly knocked offline just last week. The dangers are so high that officials have begun handing out anti-radiation iodine tablets to nearby residents. A newly unsealed FBI document about the investigation at Mar-a-Lago not only offers new details about the probe, but also reveals clues about the arguments that former President Donald Trump's legal team intends to make. A May 25th letter from one of his attorneys, attached as an exhibit to the search affidavit, advances a broad view of executive power. This is VOA News. NASA has scrubbed the launch of its new moon rocket on a no-crew test flight after a cascade of last-minute problems, including an unexplained trouble related to an engine. The next launch attempt will not be until Friday at the earliest. The 322-foot rocket was set to lift off Monday morning from Florida on its first flight, a mission to propel an empty capsule into orbit around the moon. The shakedown flight will be a big step forward in America's quest to put astronauts back on the moon for the first time since the end of the Apollo program 50 years ago. U.S. President Joe Biden will deliver a primetime address on the continued battle for the soul of the nation Thursday outside Independence Hall in the U.S. city of Philadelphia. The White House is billing it as a major address just over 2 months before the midterm elections. Biden will discuss how the nation's standing in the world and democracy are at stake. The White House says he will talk about the progress we have made as a nation to protect our democracy, but how our rights and freedoms are still under attack. He will make it clear who is fighting for those rights, fighting for those freedoms, and fighting for our democracy. U.S. First Lady Jill Biden has tested negative for COVID-19 and plans to return to Washington Tuesday. President's wife came down with a rebound case of the coronavirus nearly a week ago. Jill Biden's communication director, Elizabeth Alexander, announced the negative test on Monday night in a statement. Jill Biden has been isolating at her family's house in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, since testing positive on August 24th. At the time, her spokesperson said she was not experiencing any symptoms. She first tested positive for the virus on August 15th when she and President Joe Biden were vacationing in the U.S. state of South Carolina. Recapping our top stories, an influential Shiite cleric announced that he is resigning from Iraqi politics, and hundreds of his angry followers responded by storming the government palace. The move sparked violent clashes with security forces in which at least 15 protesters were killed. Also, a UN nuclear watchdog team set off on an urgent mission Monday to safeguard the Russian-occupied atomic power plant at the heart of fighting in Ukraine. That's been a long-awaited trip the world has been hoping will help avoid a radioactive catastrophe like Chernobyl. There is more at voanews.com. Again, voanews.com. Via remotes, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Today is Tuesday, August 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Gina Rofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, Ukraine launches counteroffensive to reclaim territories captured by Russian forces.
Natalia Kominuk, who is a spokeswoman of the Operational Command South of the Armed Forces of Ukraine, confirmed that the Armed Forces of Ukraine have launched offensive actions in many directions.
Pakistan appeals for more international aid as dead toll from devastating floods continue to rise.
Cargo planes from Turkey and the United Arab Emirates have landed in Islamabad, carrying tents, food and other daily necessities for onward transport to the hardest hit regions.
And 10 protesters killed in Baghdad as supporters of an influential cleric clash with security forces. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Ukraine says its forces have penetrated the front lines of Russia in the Kherson region. From Kyiv, Anna Chernikov updates Flashpoint Ukraine host Steve Miller.
Natalia Kominuk, who is a spokeswoman of the Operational Command South of the Armed Forces of Ukraine, confirmed that the Armed Forces of Ukraine have launched offensive actions in many directions in the south of Ukraine. But at the same time, she emphasized that the operation should be completed first before any details will be revealed or any results will be reported. Also, she added that any military operation requires silence, so she is asking not to inform before the operation is done, because there is a lot of information in the public chats of the region, so she's asking not to report anything. However, Ukrainian military also confirmed that Ukrainian forces cut Russian forces completely in terms of equipment supply to the Kherson region and manpower supply to the Kherson region from Crimea. This was confirmed early in the morning today. At the same time, we also have information from the Ukrainian military that Ukrainian troops broke through the first line of defense of the Russian forces in the Kherson region. And also this was confirmed in the morning before this announcement by the Operational Command South. Also, we hear just recently that Ukrainian forces attacked the Berislav plant in the Kherson region. And this place was a place where Russian forces kept the equipment and manpower. So certain Russian base. Reportedly, the base was quite big because currently a very huge fire is ongoing there, and we are waiting for the official information about the casualties and damages, which should be available apparently later on.
Speaking of military bases being hit, I also understand that in Ukraine's northwest, apparently Russian forces have struck a Ukrainian military base.
Yes, it happened over the weekend. It was a shelling of the military infrastructure in the Rivne region, which is northwest, as you correctly said, of Ukraine. The head of the military administration of the region confirmed that 4 missiles were fired at the military infrastructure facility in the city of Sarny, and about 30 residential buildings and the premises of the Central District Hospital were damaged by the shock wave. According to the head of the military administration, there are no human casualties reported yet. And also, again, it is no detailed information regarding any damages of the military infrastructure.
That's Anna Chernikova speaking with Flashpoint Ukraine host Steve Miller. With the war in Ukraine surpassing 6 months, what risks does the conflict pose to other countries in the region? Ivana Strader serves as advisor of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy's Barry Center for Media Integrity. She discusses that and the impact sanctions are having on Russia with Flashpoint Ukraine Steve Miller.
As per Russia's threats to Europe, I don't think that it has anything to do with NATO. This is typical Moscow rhetorics, and I do not think that Finland and Sweden joining NATO is a serious threat to Russia, because we have seen it from the very beginning that this war has nothing to do with NATO expansion. I'm way more concerned about several other things, and that might actually what's happening in Europe right now. To begin with, Russia has been weaponizing energy for years, and we might actually see a serious crisis this fall, which might actually contribute to certain changes in how different European countries, particularly Germany, will approach this war. Second thing, Russia has been also weaponizing refugees. And even though, you know, many people, military analysts, always like to focus on Russia's fighter jets and tanks and how Russia is poorly performing in Ukraine. Russia's military strategy towards Ukraine is, and Europe more broadly, is way more holistic. So, for example, how Russia has been weaponizing refugees to Europe. And I'm also very concerned what I observe right now in Africa with the food crisis, because Africa depends a lot on Ukraine grain. And the third thing is what I'm also observing is that this war might actually also cause to be destabilizing in different parts in European neighborhood. For example, Russia has been also weaponizing secessionist movements in Moldova and Georgia and Bosnia using absolutely the same playbook. And the final thought that I would like to share with you is that I'm very concerned about the rise of far-right movements in Europe. The 2023 in particular and new elections might actually contribute also to further destabilization in Europe and how Europe might actually approach this war in Ukraine.
So as someone who keeps an eye on Russian misinformation, what are you most concerned about as this war continues and there is this spread of misinformation from Moscow and a rise in far-right political parties across the world?
To begin with, I would like to emphasize that Russia is not losing the information war. Maybe Russia is losing on Twitter and when it comes to the narrative, the war in Ukraine, but Russia is successfully waging information war globally. We need to be honest with ourselves. This is the first thing. Second thing is when it comes to, it's not only about, you know, refugees. Russia has been also weaponizing information space around the bioweapons.
That's Ivana Stradner, an advisor to the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy's Barry Center for Media Integrity, speaking with Flashpoint Ukraine's Steve Miller. The IAEA has been seeking access for weeks to Europe's largest nuclear plant, with Ukrainian staff are operating under the orders of Russian forces. Edward Baran has more.
The UN nuclear watchdog will inspect the Russian-held Zaporizhia nuclear power plant in Ukraine this week. The IAEA has been requesting access amid increased military activity and rising safety fears around what's Europe's largest nuclear plant. International Atomic Energy Agency chief Rafael Grossi announced the mission on Twitter on Monday. "We must protect the safety and security of Ukraine and Europe's biggest nuclear facility," he said. Inspectors will assess damage around the facility from recent shelling and fires, which Russia and Ukraine have blamed on each other. Neither Grossi nor the IAEA specified when they'd arrive at Zaporizhia. Ukraine's energy ministry said it would not comment on the trip for security reasons. Ukrainian staff are continuing to operate the facility in southeastern Ukraine under the orders of Russian forces. On Friday, two of its six reactors were reconnected to the grid following shelling that caused the nuclear plant to be disconnected a day earlier for the first time in its history. The United Nations and Kyiv have called for a withdrawal of military equipment and personnel to ensure the Zaporizhia plant is not a target in the conflict. The IAEA tweeted separately that the mission would assess physical damage, evaluate conditions for staff, and, quote, determine the functionality of safety and security systems.
That was Edward Baran of Reuters. U.S. President Joe Biden is keeping his distance from the federal criminal investigation involving classified documents that were retained by his immediate predecessor, Donald Trump. The details from VOA's chief national correspondent Steve Herman in Washington.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre on Monday deflected numerous questions from reporters about whether President Joe Biden is concerned about national security implications related to the FBI's seizure of documents from Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence and private club in Florida.
This is a part of an investigation. The president hasn't been briefed on any of this. None of us have been briefed. The White House not has been briefed on any of this.
The press secretary added that while it is important to have transparency, the White House is not going to comment further about the documents or the possible criminal case against the former president. She did state the White House had not requested that the intelligence community undertake its assessment of possible security risks posed by Trump's retention of some classified material. Trump and his Republican supporters in Congress have accused the Department of Justice of political interference ahead of this year's midterm elections and a possible run in 2024 by the former president to recapture the White House. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
International aid is reaching Pakistan as the military and volunteers desperately try to evacuate many thousands stranded by widespread flooding driven by what has been called monster monsoons. Associated Press correspondent Charles de la Desma reports.
Cargo planes from Turkey and the United Arab Emirates have landed in Islamabad, carrying tents, food and other daily necessities for onward transport to the hardest hit regions. Also trucks carrying tents, food and water arranged by the home country's National Disaster Management Authority are getting aid to tens of thousands of flood victims. So far, exceptionally heavy monsoon rains that triggered flash floods across the country have affected 33 million Pakistanis, damaging over 1 million homes and killing over 1,000 people. I'm Charles de la Desma.
Pakistan's Foreign Minister Bhutto Zardari says the country would seek to launch an appeal asking the United Nations member states to contribute to relief efforts following devastating flooding in almost half of the country. He said after relief efforts, the country will have to look at how to develop infrastructure that is more resistant to both floods and droughts and address the huge changes faced by the agricultural sector. Planning Minister Ahsan Iqbal told Reuters that initial economic losses from floods in Pakistan could reach at least $10 billion. For more on the impact of the historic flooding, I spoke with VOA's Ayaz Gal.
Initial estimates suggest that a third of the country could be underwater because there are still forecasts of more rains in the coming days. More than 1 million houses that have been partially or fully damaged, 162 bridges damaged or destroyed. There are like 3,500 kilometers of roads have been seriously damaged because of the flooding situation. So that shows that while the rescue and relief operation, according to officials, has almost been completed, at least for this phase, if there are no more torrential rains in the coming days, but the scale of rehabilitation is massive.
The government says it's taking care and rehabilitating a lot of people in camps. What are the conditions in these camps and what are the basic priority needs of these people who are unfortunate enough to have lost everything?
Well, obviously, 33 million people, it's a large number, you know, across the country who have been affected by the flooding. It's quite a massive situation in a way that the government has to arrange shelter and food for such a large number of people. Now, what we know is that areas which were like in southern Sindh province or in northwestern provinces, these are the provinces which are quite prosperous economically. So there the camp situation, the camps were established quickly and people were able to reach these camps and now they're being fed and international assistance is also arriving. But the situation is really bad in southwestern Balochistan province, which is the largest province of the country area-wise. It's sparsely populated. And that's where bringing in aid and providing shelter quickly to the victims is a challenging situation for the authorities. The reason is that this province has been cut off because all four highways that link Balochistan with the rest of the countries were flooded in a way that all communications with that province remains suspended. Even telecommunication systems were down for almost 3-4 days, but although some of it has been restored. But that's where the situation is really challenging for the authorities, for rescue workers.
That's VOA's Ayaz Gal speaking with me from Islamabad. In other news, gunfire was heard in the green zone of Baghdad on Monday night as clashes continued following an announcement by Iraq's powerful Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr that he will quit politics. Earlier in the day, Sadr's loyalists stormed the Palasha government complex in Baghdad following the announcement, which led to clashes with rival Shiite groups. At least 10 were killed. As night fell, machine gun fire and explosions rang out, with trace of fire rising into the sky above the green zone that houses government headquarters and foreign embassies in the worst fighting the Iraqi capital has seen in years. Sadr later said he was staging a hunger strike in protest against the use of weapons by all sides. A political standoff between Sadr and Shiite Muslim rivals, who are mostly backed by Iran, has sent Iraq spiraling into yet another round of violence as it struggles to recover from decades of war, sanctions, civil strife, and endemic corruption. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. A spokesman for forces in Ethiopia's Tigray region is denying a report that Tigrayan forces have captured a town in the neighboring Amhara region. Renewed clashes broke out last week between the Tigray People's Liberation Front and the Ethiopian government after a five-month lull. Harry Wilkins reports from Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa.
On Sunday night, some international media reported that the TPLF had entered the Amhara region town of Weldia. Speculation also spread on social media. However, Monday, a TPLF representative told VOA that these claims were false, saying Tigrayan forces have not yet entered the town. So far, the renewed fighting has been centred around the town of Kobo, farther north. Weldia sits just over 300 kilometres from Addis Ababa and is a strategic point on the road leading south from the Tigray region's capital, Mekele, to Addis Ababa. Any movements by the TPLF further south could set alarm bells ringing for the federal government. Last year, the TPLF came within 200 kilometres from Addis after it took the town of Desi on the same road. Both the Ethiopian government and the TPLF have blamed each other for triggering the clashes last week that ended a five-month ceasefire in Ethiopia's civil war. On Friday, it was reported that an Ethiopian government airstrike hit a kindergarten in Tigray, killing at least seven people. The government accused the TPLF of staging images of the attack. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Thank you, Henry. Nicole Onapu Man has waited 9 long years for her chance to go into space. And if all goes according to plan, the wait will end on October 3, when she will lead NASA's Crew 5 missions to the International Space Station. Rosanna Pifot of Reuters reports.
Astronaut Nicole Mann is set to become the first Native American woman in space after waiting 9 long years for her chance to go.
I'm extremely excited. It has been a long journey, but it's been so well worth it.
On October the 3rd, 2022, she will lead NASA's Crew 5 mission to the International Space Station. While John Herrington was the first Native American astronaut to make it to space in 2002, Mann would be the first woman to break that barrier.
To be honest, I think I feel very proud. It's important that we, celebrate our diversity and really communicate that specifically to the younger generation. Because I know there's kids out there that live perhaps in a community where there are barriers. And I want them to know that these barriers are being broken down or can be broken down. You know, in the same breath, operationally here at NASA, it's really great to be able to say it really doesn't matter. Right, our astronauts are trained across the board, qualified for missions. And so we're really getting to a point in our kind of evolution as a society that operationally we don't highlight or distinguish based on gender or race or religion. We distinguish based on your ability to execute the job.
Mann is a member of the Wailaki of the Round Valley Indian tribes in Northern California. She says that her upcoming mission has sparked excitement in her community.
I still live in Northern California area where the Round Valley tribes are located. And there's been, what's really neat is a lot of interest from these news outlets and from these sources from the Native American outlets. And that's really, I think, an audience that we don't get an opportunity to reach out to very often.
Mann is a Marine colonel with a master's in mechanical engineering. She was recruited into NASA in 2013 and finished candidate training 2 years later.
It's always been just a kind of a far future concept in my mind. And so what we're doing in low Earth orbit not only trains the astronauts, but provides the technical development and the operational concepts that we're going to need to live sustained human presence on the moon and eventually take us to Mars.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists led by the Geological Survey of Denmark and Greenland have released what many would consider a disturbing new study in the journal Nature Climate Change. According to a recent press release from the organization, study authors have, for the first time, been able to determine the least amount of ice lost so far from the Greenland ice sheet due to climate change. The study suggests that even if the whole world stopped using fossil fuels today, at its current rate, about 110 quadrillion metric tons of ice would still be lost from the Greenland ice sheet, which in turn would cause the global sea level to rise by at least 27 centimeters. Study researchers point out that their findings are based on 20 years of actual measurements instead of models. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Go beyond the daily headlines with VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. Each weekday, join us as we put the latest developments into a global context with stories, interviews, and analysis. Listen online at voanews.com/flashpoint or in your favorite podcast player.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voaafrica.com. Until next time, I am Chinua Duafo in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Nearly 20 million people living in the Horn of Africa are facing a crisis of food insecurity. The region has suffered four consecutive droughts and is looking at a fifth come October. The Horn region has two rainy seasons per year, said USAID Administrator Samantha Power, who recently visited some of the most seriously affected regions in Somalia and Kenya. This is the first time in history, she stressed at a recent talk here in Washington, that the Horn of Africa has suffered four consecutive failed rainy seasons.
Today, pasture lands are turning to dust, and in near biblical scenes, weakened farm animals are dying of disease. To date, at least 7 million livestock have already died in Ethiopia, Kenya, and Somalia. There just isn't enough water to quench their thirst or enough grass to feed them.
Through the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, the government of the United States is providing critical humanitarian assistance totaling $1.2 billion to the three most severely affected countries in the region, Ethiopia, Kenya, and Somalia. Early humanitarian investments are critical to saving lives. In Ethiopia this year alone, the United States is providing $668 million in support of more than 8.1 million people whose survival is threatened by the historic drought. In Kenya, the drought has pushed more than 4 million people to the edge of starvation, with communities in the arid and semi-arid land countries having been hit the hardest. By the end of May, some 70% of crops were reported lost, along with at least 2.4 million head of livestock. USAID is providing to the people of Kenya nearly $255 million in emergency food and other critical humanitarian and development assistance. And in Somalia, 7.1 million people are affected by this crisis. More than 3 million agricultural animals have died, and 1.4 million children are facing acute malnutrition through the end of the year. USAID is providing $476 million in critical humanitarian and development aid to the people of Somalia, bringing the U.S. total assistance for this year to more than $707 million. This humanitarian aid illustrates the United States' continuing commitment to the welfare of the people of Ethiopia, Kenya, and Somalia. We urge other partner governments, said Administrator Power, to join us in significantly increasing their own commitments to prevent widespread famine and millions of deaths.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.